And how about, are you already a commercial cider maker? Fantastic. And do we have any cider enthusiasts, folks who just love cider and make it at home? That's fantastic. Well, welcome everyone.
This week on Cider Chat, it is part one of the Beginning Cider Makers panel, pre-recorded at CiderCon 2019. This is episode 174, and you are listening to Cider Chat. Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Rhea Windcaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks in the cider trade from around the world. We're going to do a little bit of news out and about in Ciderville, and then we'll be going with our main feature, Beginning Cider Makers Panel, pre-recorded at CiderCon 2019. For those of you who are new to this here podcast, we do a little bit of news out and about in Ciderville, and then we go to the main feature. Again, that's going to be a Beginning Cider Makers Q&A pre-recorded at CiderCon. So we'll get to that shortly. But in the meantime, I would like you to join with me tipping your glass to South Africa, a region of the world, a spot in Ciderville that we don't hear too much about. At least I don't. Well, because I'm on a different continent. And I don't really know many commercial brands there. I follow a few. And it's, you know, I mean, I feel like I'm on the journey with you going out and about in Ciderville and meeting folks. So let's all raise a glass to all the makers down there, all the cider drinkers and the folks who are bringing the apple forward. One in specific, that would be William, who just left a 5-star review and rating at the Cider Chat Facebook page. He wrote, "Such an experience and source of information for myself here in South Africa to listen to the podcasts of Rhea on Cider Chat." William, wow. When I read that and I saw South Africa, I felt that the world was a little bit more attainable for me, and all based on that perfect glass. So thank you. Thank you for taking that time. That means a lot. The fact that you left a 5-star means a lot. It helps promote this podcast for people who might, in other, you know, scenes, might not have even an idea that it's happening. So thank you, thank you. I raise my glass to you and wish you good luck. And keep me posted so I could keep listeners of this here podcast posted on what's happening down in that area. I would love to hear more. Speaking of Facebook and social media in general, a few days ago, it was April 1st, and I did post a kind of a funny thing. It's called Palm Stars Fall 2020, and there's a GIF of a pair dancing in on the GIF. And I wrote 0.0 Productions to produce Palm Stars, a global journey bobbing along the Palm Trail. First episode to air on CNN in fall 2020. And it's going to be featuring prime cider and perry-making locations worldwide. They would be awarding palm stars to restaurants, makers, and territories that feature the perfect palm-based drinks and food pairings. Now, folks were liking this in different social media outlets that I hooked up to, and I want to say it was an April Fool's joke. In my wildest dreams, I would hope that this would be a reality, that folks would say, hey, you know, I could get behind this. You know, the 0.0 Productions produced Anthony Bourdain, No Reservations and Parts Unknown. So why not a bobbing along the Palm Trail from Kazakhstan and beyond? But alas, I'm sorry if I've misled you, but it's April Fool's and I just had to get in there. And, you know, maybe I could have been a little bit more transparent, but that was the best I could do. And I just appreciate the people who maybe were taken by that and thought that it could be a reality, that actually that Cider Chat and the Talking Palms and myself producing this, now like going in my 5th year of producing this podcast, 174 episodes as of this one, that maybe there'd be enough sharing and enough talk about Cider Chat that that possibility could be there, that you believed in that. That just is swell. That's really swell. Thank you. I'm sorry if I've kind of let you down. not my intention. It was just kind of getting in on the joke. And I don't want to joke about this stuff. I mean, I really believe that that could be a rock solid, awesome travelogue show. No doubt about it. But until we get an actual production crew to kind of gobble that up and maybe a little bit of more support to support this podcast, it's not happening. But there you have it. All right. So we're going to take a little pause here, moving further into April, and just a wee bit more of news out and about in Siderville. Is it apple blossom season where you are right now? Are those buds just kind of teasing you, saying, I'm almost open, but not quite? Or are you like wallowing in the bouquet of apple blossoms? Well, wherever you are, I hope your glass is full. I know that there's a lot of folks that still waiting, still a long ways off from apple blossom. So hang tight. It will come. When this podcast goes live on April 3rd, I will be landing in California, gearing up for the Monterey Bay Cider Tour. Can't wait to see everybody next week and heading off into the amazing landscape of this region here. Just absolutely beautiful. Talking about dry farming practices, grafting, and doing a lot of cider tasting. So it's going to be tons of fun. And there's been some fun stuff like in the pre, you know, a little bit unique. Every cider tour is a little bit unique. This one in particular, because we're going to the S. Martinelli and Company, which is a giant juice plant. I mean, they make a lot of apple juice, and that is what they're really at this point well known worldwide as, a huge producer of apple juice, sparkling apple juice, the gold medal Martinelli apple juice. However, those listeners of Cider Chat in the know would have listened perhaps to episode 165 with John Martinelli and would have realized that, holy cazoli, Martinelli's have been making cider since 1865. They started off as a fermenter of cider, an alcoholic cider, not the apple juice that they're so well known in so many circles nowadays. They then continued to make cider up to Prohibition, stopped, and then reignited the fermentation scene in 1933 and kept fermenting cider all the way up to 1979, stopped for a little bit, and then kicked back into the cider scene in 2018. So we're going there first, and because they're not really making cider on the site, we're going to have the juice perspective. We're going to meet John Martinelli. We're going to get to taste some of their 1868 cider. They're doing like a special event just for this cider tour because this is something they do not do. And they're allowing us into this cider plant. We have to get dressed for the occasion. And I got this list that I didn't then sent to all the folks on the tour to prepare. As such, we all have to make sure we have correct footwear. It starts there. You know, you can't just wear open-toed shoes or sandals. Even if it's 70 degrees out and it's in California, we're going to have to wear leather, rubber-soled shoes. So I'm really hoping nobody forgets that, because as it is, I have to, like, I've been like using glue goop to like put together an old pair of leather shoes that I think will pass the muster of the Oompa Loompas at Martinelli's. And really, there's no Oompa Loompas there. I'm just kind of kidding. It is April Fool's, so I could kind of joke a little bit, right? And it is Siderville. But truthfully, you know, they're worried about that. We're going to be wearing hair nets, beard nets, and all kinds of stuff. And it's going to just be quite a scene. So in the meanwhile, I've been getting photos of different shoes that folks are saying, Rhea, do you think this is okay? And honestly, I don't know. I'm just kind of following the script. It says leather, rubber soled. I'm going with that. Nobody wants to miss out on this tour. We're all gearing up. Can't wait to go in. We're going to enter on one side of the complex, and we're going to walk out the door on the other side of the complex. And it should be really something. So I'm sure you'll hear more about that as it rolls along. But there's nothing like that insider look. And that's why people are coming on this tour, to get that insider look. We go there. Then we're going to be hanging out with Santa Cruz Cider Company. Nicole, Natalie, doing a tasting there, walking around the orchard. Being in an orchard where there's apple trees and then redwood trees and a sequoia, it's a little like out of the script. If you're up in Vermont right now, or I don't know, some parts of Canada have redwoods too, I'm sure. But for the most part, it's not something that's very normal. It's just kind of boggles the mind, and it's almost like incongruent. This does not compute. So we're going to pull that all together, especially those of us coming from outside of the region, and to walk about in that scene. Again, with Santa Cruz Cider Company, we're going to get to hang out with Robbie Honda of Tanuki Cider. Then the next day, we'll be going over to Five Mile Orchard, hanging out with Jake Mann, this multi-generational orchardist, checking out his scene. This is a location that has really been supplying that whole valley, the Parajo Valley, well known as the apple producer, mighty, mighty apple producer, one of the largest apple producing regions in the U.S. at one time. Isn't that interesting how things ebb and flow? And also hanging out with Ryder Ranch, doing a tasting of their Newtown Pippins. Really righteous cider makers there. Then we'll be heading over to Serenventi Ranch, walking the orchard, having lunch. By that time, I think we're going to have like a little bit of a break time so people could chill out a little bit, because the evening we're going to have an amazing cider dinner. And going to SoCal Cider and their beautiful, beautiful organic farm, sitting out in the orchard under like a setting. It's an outdoor dinner. Some of us in our different spots of Ciderville could only dream of being able to do that, having an outdoor cider dinner. But this is going to be classic California, and we're going to do it up. Not to mention riding around in the Betty Jane, that tricked out 1970s something school bus with Annie at the helm. I can't wait. Really excited to be back in a home port of mine, hanging with all these beautiful people coming in from all different locations in the U.S. to gather to Monterey Bay. So stay tuned for that. I'll give a little bit of a follow-up, and do consider cider tours. What a novel idea. When I come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about that, and then we'll be moving on with our main feature. Now is the time to go to Europe. I want you to really think about that. Do not delay. The euro is at an all-time low, making it very possible for me to offer to you an extraordinary holiday in Normandy, France, experiencing the cider and Perry, being able to sightsee at a kick-ass price. Go to the Totally Cider page at ciderchat.com. Do not delay. I can't say how long that rate is going to stay at that price point right now. I'm trying to keep it low for you. But those who are waiting and saying, oh, I could put it off until May or June, it's just not going to fly. So make your reservations now for the Normandy Cider Tour. If you have any questions, just email me, Rhea@ciderchat.com. Now it's time to grab a glass and sit back and listen to the Beginner's Cider Maker Question and Answer Seminar. This was pre-recorded at CiderCon 2019. There were 5 panelists, and the audience was allowed to come up to a microphone and ask questions all about cider making. Now, in the beginning of this here episode 174, you heard me calling out who here was a commercial cider maker, who is a startup, who's just a cider fan, because I was assessing from the audience a little bit about who was in that room and what kind of questions we were going to be getting. I was also running down to my recorder to press record, because right after I had introduced everyone, I had just realized that I wasn't recording this amazing seminar. So that's a little bit what was going on there. And now I'd like to rewind and once again introduce the panelists. If you go to the show notes, you'll be able to see a photo of all 5. I'm going to start from left and go to right. We had next to the podium and myself was Marcus Robert. He is a 4th-generation farmer from the Yakima Valley of Washington State. So that's based in Southern Washington. And he was on the podcast on episode 121 that was called Keeving Perry, Titan Cider Works. Marcus is the operations manager at Titan Cider Works. Again, he's a longtime farmer, orchardist, and is also very involved in Fontaine Winery. So the dude has it going on there. He's also on the board of the United States Association of Cider Makers. Sitting next to Marcus is Tim Godfrey. Tim originally is from Michigan, but these days he is the head cider maker and director of production at Golden State Cider, based in Sebastopol, California. Next up, in the center of this panel, was Eleanor Leger, a.k.a., in my mind, the Queen of Ice Cider. Eleanor is the founder of Eden Specialty Ciders of Vermont. Eden was established in 2007 and is the leading producer of ice ciders and heritage ciders in the U.S. And certainly, again, the Queen of Ice Cider, she is just like the go-to person for people to ask everything about that, has helped so many people across the board. She's also served on the board of the United States Association of Cider Makers and was recently re-elected to the board, so she's back on it. She's a member of the Vermont Working Landscape Enterprise Board and was the founder of Vermont Cider Makers Association. In addition to leading the team at Eden, Eleanor writes about the economics of cider production at cidernomics.com. You can listen to a podcast episode with Eleanor Leger by going to episode 111, Cidernomics, Breaking Bad or Breaking Even with Eleanor Leger. Also on the panel is Brent Miles from Sly Clyde Ciderworks. He was the original head cider maker at Seattle Cider Company and is most recently the head cider maker at Sly Clyde Ciderworks. And he's just launched Brown Hat, a cider consulting company. And we also had Ben Calvi. He's not only on the board of the United States Association of Cider Makers, he's a treasurer, but he's also the director of cider making for Vermont Hard Cider Company based in Middlebury, Vermont. So that is five cider makers and me hanging out ready to rock and roll. So let's now grab a glass and head to this main feature, the Beginner's Cider Maker Q&A, pre-recorded at CiderCon.
A little bit of my roots, going back to 1994 is when I first started teaching cider making at Franklin County Cider Days, which is the oldest cider fest in the U.S. And I taught that for about 16 years. And through all that, a big question was, well, how do you describe cider? So I want to throw that out to the panel here, because that's a key thing when you're doing a commercial operation is, how do you begin with that classic question? People come in, and that educational piece is, what is cider? So I want to throw that out to the panel.
Very, very contentious question.
No, I'm not shy. I'll answer it.
Okay, Eleanor's going for it.
Cider is the fermented fruit of apples.
Fermented fruit of apples?
Fermented juice of apples, yeah. It's like asking, what is wine? It's huge and varied and whatever you want it to be. And the most important thing to do is to know and understand how the cider that you want to make and the choices that you make about the cider are going to impact the nature of your business.
Pretty spot on. Now, the way that this panel is set up and the way this seminar this morning is there a center microphone. Because it's hard to hear, I'm really going to recommend one is, you know, we're all on the same boat here. So no question is a ridiculous question. And so please, if you have a question, this is your form to do that. Because most likely there's a good chance that somebody is thinking that same question too. So if you've been coming in here thinking, you know, I'm really trying to figure out equipment needs, this panel has like an immense amount of information to offer. So we're hoping that folks will kind of come up to the microphone, ask a question so everybody could hear, and then the panel will discuss. So we know the classification cider. But what's also like, though, looking back over your career, what you're doing now, if you could speak on, you know, I wish I knew then what I know now.
That's actually something I talk
Marcus Robert.
Talk about quite a bit to other cideries that are wanting to start up or thinking about it. And, you know, looking back, we started out as a small cidery. We, our first year, we did a few hundred cases. We thought at that point, you know, 11, 12 years ago, if we thought if we sold 1,000 cases a year, that'd be fantastic, and we've definitely grown beyond that point. But looking back, we did a lot of capital investment into stainless steel and infrastructure and that sort of thing, and kind of missed the boat on the marketing aspect. And that's really the biggest learning curve that you're going to have. You're going to learn how to make cider. Okay, and we can make a lot of cider, but to be able to sell it and understand the markets you need to get to sell that product, even if your business plan isn't to go with a distributor, understanding how just simple things like how to service an account correctly. Because I was talking to somebody the other day that said, I didn't realize I had to go to the account when I dropped off my keg and then go back and check on it and present them and say, well, I think you need a new keg. They don't even call me. The account doesn't even call me to say that they're out of cider. And so there's just a simple thing like that, understanding how to self-distribute, understanding how to talk to people, understand. I mean, there's a huge learning curve there in the sales and marketing portion of it, and that's where the vast majority of your efforts should go to begin with, because really without that, you're just producing a very expensive hobby, and you maybe end up drinking a lot of the cider yourself. So,
yeah. Brent Miles.
One thing that is not always apparent when you first get started and you're kind of in the cellar banging your head against different problems is that most of the problems that you're going to face are not new or unique to you. And so CiderCon is really great for, like Michelle was saying earlier, these 2 a.m. conversations where you realize that you aren't alone and trying to figure out why your cider isn't clarifying or, you know, whatever equipment problem you have. And so just to remember that, especially other people who are your size or used to be your size, have seen and met a lot of the challenges that you're facing. And so just be humble and ask questions. And normally something that you maybe developed this weird workaround for, maybe that is the correct one way to solve that problem, but maybe another cidery that you just have to ask the right question has found a better, more flexible way of solving it. So just don't get too siloed and don't think that these problems that are going to come up are you're the first person that that's happened to.
Great. Well, it looks like we have our first a question. I really recommend, before you ask that question, and this is also true in the room, to make sure that you look at the people that are sitting next to you, introduce yourselves, because this is a network. You could make friends forever right now. So it'd be really great to kind of know who you are, just where you're located.
My name is Eddie Gutierrez, and I work at St. Arnold Brewing Company in Houston, Texas. We are brand new to cider, and in fact, we're launching at the end of this month with about 10,000 gallons. So I don't really have a history of making cider, so this is very scary for me. And my question is actually from a QAQC standpoint, the thought of residual sugar in a packaged product in beer is just a nightmare. And so, you know, we use a centrifuge to kind of remove any debris and yeast, and we're planning on kind of aiming on the low end for sulfite additions. But does anybody have any experience in terms of rules of thumb to kind of set yourself up for success and not end up with bombs in package?
Good question.
Ben. Ben Calvi.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's one all of us have probably faced at some point, having cider with residual sugar in the market, and then you get a phone call saying, I think it's fermenting. Either the bottle caps are popping off or the keg tastes a little funny. You want to do a few things. You have a few options. If you have residual sugar, you got to make sure that it doesn't ferment in the can or bottle or keg, and it will. So you either have to sterile filter. You want to go down to 0.45 micron, so read a good wine book. So you want to get it down to sterile filter so no yeast or bacteria can go through there. After that, you have a couple choices. You can pasteurize your product with heat after it's in the package, or you could use preservatives like sulfites and potassium sorbate. There's other things like DMDC or Velcorin. So there's different ways to preserve your product. You want to make sure you understand the science of each one of those. But yeah, if you're going to have residual sugar in your cider, don't send it to market without some sort of stabilization. The other thing you want to do if you have the resources is once you package something, you can plate it for micros. So we plate every 3 hours of production to make sure that what's in the package doesn't have any live micros. You probably don't have labs to do that, but for $50, maybe you send a representative sample to a lab like Enardis or ETS or something, and they'll plate it for you, and they'll tell you if there's anything still alive in there.
Yeah, so we actually have a PCR, so we can find out within like 3 hours if there's anything living, and that's just kind of the infrastructure that we had in place for beer. Our plan was to use sulfites, no sterile filtration, only a centrifuge, but I don't know if that's...
It's not enough.
No. To be extremely clear, sulfites are not a stabilizer, so they are not going to stop yeast re-fermentation. Right. So, yeah, you needed one of the four things that Ben talked about. You just need to pick one and obviously know the reasons. But, yeah, sterile filtration, Velcorin, pasteurization, or sorbate. But sulfite is not one of those stabilizers. So,
yeah, I was going to say really quick, sometimes what I found when I started making cider years ago is that the tech I had influenced the type of cider I could make. As we've grown, we've been able to afford new tech, and that's made us able to make the cider that we really do want to make. But sometimes you have to design the cider to what you're able to do, and at that point, like to echo what people are saying, I think that it would be a challenge for sure to achieve any stability on that.
I'll just add sterile filtration. While it sounds great and often is more accessible for smaller producers, you have to be damn sure that between the filter and the package, you're also sterile. And frankly, you aren't. So while people say yeah, sterile filtration, for me, that's like theoretically possible, but practically don't do it. And then the issue with sorbate is it's good for a while, but it doesn't last forever. You need, you know, if you're in a fast turnaround situation where you're just putting stuff in kegs and it's going through to get the kegs back and it's not sitting out in the market for a month, you're fine. If you're doing bottles, 750 ml bottles that might go sit on a shelf for 6 months, it's probably not great. So the challenges for smaller producers around ciders with residual sugar are real and difficult.
One thing to think about your marketing, because I keep going back to marketing and sales, is that if you do utilize sorbates, most, if not all, natural markets will not buy your product, because they will not sell products with potassium sorbate or any other sorbate in it.
Okay.
Even though wine has it, and they do sell this.
Yeah, and some natural markets make exceptions for wine products, but like Whole Foods doesn't. So.
Yeah.
But you have to label sorbates.
If you come find any of us after and pick us, the best thing to do is between seminars, walk up to someone and say, I have a follow-up question, I have more to do. Come grab one of us, and we can talk to you for 20 minutes, and there's a lot of options.
Okay, awesome. Thank you.
Bonus. We have somebody up at the microphone, so we're going to just kind of go there. Sorry.
Hi, my name is Michelle Pagano. I work at a brewery in New York City called LIC Beer Project, but I've been gravitating towards the cider world more as a home brewer and cider maker. When you're getting ready to start the next step after your business plan, you've got the location, et cetera. In your experience, has it been more beneficial to do gypsy brewing versus tap room? I've seen the beer industry, they've been doing both, and it's been successful, but I just want to know from your point of view.
Basically contract.
Right, contract, I'm sorry, production. To be clear, yes.
Yeah, and we would say fermentation, not brewing, yeah.
Well, yeah hence...
Right. I like gypsy brewing, though. That's
so I think part of the question, the first answer to that question is how much money do you have? Because if you're constrained in resources, the most important thing is to get some product made someplace and get your brand on it and go out and start selling it. Like, the less money you spend before you actually start testing your product with customers, the better. Because you just don't want to put a whole bunch of money in something and then... like 3 months later, I'm out with my product, and it's like, it doesn't work. You don't know what you're doing. It's just, yeah. So that's my first recommendation. If you have lots of money, go ahead and spend it.
Yeah, because I've noticed in the beer world that there's been a struggle with those who have been doing contract brewing and then opening up a tap room. They just kind of have a setback, or it ends up failing completely. So you wouldn't see that's similar trend in the cider world?
Well, I think in some ways cider is easier because you don't need to invest in a brew house, and there's less people who are doing contract. And so sometimes people's options are just limited. Like, there's not a cidery near them that has excess capacity to ferment for them. And also the capital investment as opposed to beer is lower because you don't need a brew house, you don't need a boiler. And so I think it can be a good way to start, but you need to trust the contractor. And then, like Marcus has been saying, you have to think about your marketing as well. Like, you're going to have to put on your label who produces it, and it's not you. And whether that is going to pay dividends down the line, like, it might be easier to get started, but it's not really going to help you build a following if you're like, well, I don't really make this product.
It really depends on the story you're telling, though. So if you go down to a local winery and have partner with them, you say, hey, the story is I've partnered with this winery to help me produce the best ciders we could produce so I could bring cider to you. If you tell the story about that, consumers will think that's very, actually, quite quaint and neat and
There's a difference that I think you're referring to, Marcus, which is cider is not beer. It's made from apples. And when you're talking about beer, it is all about the beer production process and the recipe and the I'm the cook, I'm the chef. But cider is about apples. And if your story is about the apples, you can talk. I mean, the fermentation, you want it to be done well and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, it depends what your marketing strategy is again. But there's a lot about apples that can be your story that is more important, frankly, than like whose tank it was in.
Got it. Thank you.
Great question.
Hi, everyone. My name is Alexander Ionov. I'm a cider maker from Moscow, Russia. And I have three questions to Eleanor about iCider.
First of all, why don't we meet afterwards unless anybody else wants to know them?
Okay, so I've been making cider for 3 years, and I wanted to do some experiments with iCider, and I suppose that I even used some of your guides about making iCider in small batch. And the most problem for me was to stabilize iCider, because I did several rankings, I add sulfites, and it seemed to be stabilized for some time, but in several months, no matter, it started to re-ferment in bottles. So this is the first question, if it's possible to stabilize it without sterile filtration. The second question is, which yeast strain you are consider as to be the best for iCider? And the third one, if cryo extraction is not possible, and I have to use cryo concentration, it's impossible to, or it's a huge task to keep the juice in a fresh condition, since it's pressed, for example, in November, till the very freezing weather in January, as it happens in Russia, or even February. So if I use a freezer, am I cheating?
How many people are interested in iCider? Oh, good. Okay, cool. All right. I'll answer the questions. Usually it's like one poor person and I'm like off in a corner. That's awesome. All right. So those are three great questions that I often get. Okay. So let me do the yeast one first. You need a yeast that basically does the job you want it to do for iCider, right? So it's got to be comfortable getting started in a very high sugar juice, yeah, right? So that, like, it needs to get going well. You want it to have a pretty good kill factor so it gets rid of other stuff and it's just going on. And you want it to be temperature sensitive because the way you're really going to stop the fermentation is through cold crashing the tank. And you need a yeast that just says, okay, I'm dying.
Okay.
Very gracefully. Other than that, most ice ciders you're going to age a bit in the tank or in a barrel before you bottle them. So any impact, sort of flavor impact from a yeast doesn't release, those sort of fresh fruity kind of ester stuff don't survive sort of over a long period of aging. So it doesn't really matter that much, except to the extent that your yeast, if it's not happy, is going to make off flavors that you want to avoid. So I would say pick any Saccharomyces cerevisiae yeast, you'll be fine. Saccharomyces byanus, stay away from it because it's impossible to kill. So I don't know if you were using a champagne yeast, that would have been a problem. It's like it'll come back.
Yeah.
We talked about stabilization. So there are three ways to get to stabilization, right? You can throw a ton of sulfites and all kinds of stuff at it. You can cross-flow filter and get everything out. Or you can cold, which what we do is just cold crash the tank. But again, you have to use a yeast that's temperature sensitive. So we bring the temperature, when you know you want to stop the fermentation, bring the temperature down to 27 degrees Fahrenheit, 30, around there.
And usually, is it the way you usually do?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So we have a glycol chiller that we end up running 3 weeks out of the year when we're cold crashing ice cider fermentations.
Okay. So.
And rack it. Keep it at that temperature, rack it, keep it at that temperature, and then we just let it gradually come back up to cellar temperature, and it's darn stable. We don't filter until just before it goes in the bottle. That could be 2 years.
Okay.
So it is pretty darn, it's a very tough environment for a yeast that's not acclimated to the environment to get in and start doing something. So the fact that yours isn't stable tells me that you didn't kill the yeast that was in your tank.
Okay.
It wasn't something coming in and getting something restarted. Because it's high alcohol, it's high sugar still,
yeah,
high acid,
exactly.
Things don't get started. We've tried to take a thing of ice cider and get it going again, and it's like impossible. and your last, did I cover everything?
Freezing.
Cheating. Are you cheating? we do almost all of our ice cider through cryo concentration outdoors because cryo extraction, because the cellulose in the apples breaks down when you freeze the apple, you start having decomposition happening in ways that really change the flavors. And we work with very interesting heirloom and unique apple varieties. We really want to preserve and showcase the aromas and the flavors of those apples. So cryoconcentration does that a lot better than cryoextraction does. We live in northern Vermont in zone 3B at 1,400 feet elevation. We were able to put juice outside December 8th this year and have it be reliably below freezing. So if you use a freezer and only a freezer, yes, you're cheating. In this country, you would not supposedly be able to get a label that says ice cider. You can get a label that says iced cider, but not one that says ice cider. If you do end up using a freezer, what I often tell people is, if you can, take it out of the freezer, put it back in the freezer, take it out of the freezer, and put it back in the freezer, because the advantage of outdoor natural cold weather concentration is actually the fluctuation up and down. We'll be minus 35 Fahrenheit to plus 20. It's a 55 degree temperature variation all below freezing, and it's that up and down that helps separate out the super... all the sugars and the flavors that will trickle down to the bottom from the ice that will stay up at the top. If you just put it in a freezer, boom, it's frozen. A lot of that stuff is still trapped in the matrix of the ice, and you don't get it. So you get a lower yield, and you get less flavor.
Okay, that's interesting. Thank you.
Okay.
Great, good luck.
Great. Why don't we just table ice cider for anyone else later? Go back to the stuff.
Hi, folks. My name's Richie Roberts. I'm a winemaker from Fielding State Winery in Canada. And a fair-sized winery, and we've gotten into cider the last couple years. One of the biggest challenges we've faced in comparison to wine is settling juice prior to fermentation. I was just wondering if you had any tips for that. What we've been doing is strictly using temperature, and we get a lot of issues in terms of freezing out water, which we don't normally get in juice for grapes. In terms of flotation or enzymes, or any turbidity goals that you're looking for?
Do you know what percent solids you're bringing in?
No, actually I don't. No, in terms of like sugar, they're normally between 11.5 to 13 Brix.
And when we press, we bring in a lot of the juice that we end up having is somewhere between 2 and 3% solids. It's a little heavy for what we're trying to accomplish. So we experiment with flotation. There's a lot of success there. We incorporate a centrifuge into our process at one point, so we can do a quick pass if we get something that is pretty heavy. But yeah, generally we're trying to get to like 0.5% solids is where we see like a really positive impact on our product. Cold settling is hard because you get this like by the time you're in the last third of the tank, it's just one continuous like kind of getting worse and worse and worse, and you end up taking big losses, and then that kind of hurts your margin. So if you have any ability to do any mechanical separation, I think that's what I'd recommend for sure. Okay.
If you don't know your percent solids, you can get a little tabletop centrifuge, mm-hmm. and you spin down your tubes and figure out how much solids in there. It could be your choice of apples. Some are really high, like early season in Vermont, there's Paula Reds, like 10% solids. And if you try to ferment with something like that, you're going to struggle. We just use enzymes, and after a few days at cold temperature, the suspended solids drop out, generally speaking.
Okay, great, thanks.
Great. That was part one of the Beginner Cider Maker Q&A recorded at CiderCon 2019. On the panel, once again, was Marcus Robert of Titan Cider Works in Washington State, Tim Godfrey of Golden State Cider in California, Eleanor Leger of Eden Specialty Cider, Vermont, Brent Miles, Sly Clyde Cider in Virginia, and Ben Calvi of Vermont Cider Company in Vermont. We went over a lot of things in that little workshop there, or again, a Q&A, beginning with what is cider, or wish I knew then what I know now, breweries getting into cider, managing residual sugar in the bottle before packaging, the downfall of potassium sorbates in the natural market. I thought that was kind of a key thing because that's a big up-and-coming topic, contract fermenting to test product perhaps, ice cider from Alexander in Moscow. I met Alexander while at CiderCon, and it was really neat. I hope to catch up with him at a future cider event for sure, where we could find out a little bit more about what's happening in Russia. And that was a little bit on stabilization and cryo concentration. That was very interesting with Eleanor Leger, the queen of ice cider, talking about the fact that you get a different product when you are actually using the natural fluctuation of outdoor temperatures versus putting the cider in a freezer. And she knows what she's talking about, no doubt about that. Next week, we're going to be doing part two of this Q&A piece. I'll begin with a little intro once again, and then we'll go right into talking about plastic versus stainless. Can you make money being a commercial maker? What is the best cider style to offer? Do you need 3 to 4 core ciders, maybe 8? Where to locate a cidery? Should you take out a loan or go full into cider making, maybe use Kickstarter? And what's the most crucial piece of lab equipment to have starting out as a cider maker? So a bit more ahead on part two, that'll be coming up in episode 175.
Next week will be the 175th episode of Cider Chat, which is a little bit awe-inspiring even to me, the person who produces it, all by my lonesome. Certainly a little bit of help from the Talking Palms, but, you know, they're cartoon characters. What can I say? Don't tell them. Anyways, if you find value from this podcast, then please spread the news. Let your friends know who are into cider, folks who maybe want to make cider, or maybe even commercial makers who have no idea that there is a cider podcast out there in the world. And while you're at it, let them know about the Totally Cider Tour going to Normandy, France, the last week of September. It is going to be an amazing trip, a fantastic itinerary with world-class cider makers behind the scenes and sightseeing at world-class locations. It's been quite interesting to me, going back to Mont Saint-Michel. Yet again, I mentioned to somebody that we're going to Mont Saint-Michel. Do you know that place? And they're like, no, I don't. And which just surprises me because it's just one of those spots like going to the Taj Mahal. Yet it's in France. It's just such a blow you over your own heels kind of place. It's surrounded by water. The water rises up and then Mont Saint-Michel becomes its own island. And we're going to be spending the night out there. And you could walk out on the mud flats, but you have to be really careful and definitely go with a guide because it could be like quicksand. Just Google Mont Saint-Michel and the mud flats, and you'll see what I'm talking about. And from there, you could kind of look back at the French coastline or look out towards the English Channel and just get a sense of the majesty of this landscape while sipping on some cider, because that evening we'll be having a cider dinner yet again. Tons of fun. Share the news. Share Cider Chat and the Totally Cider Tours. Not only will you be doing yourself a favor because you'll be making sure that this podcast is staying on the air, but you'll also make some friends very happy knowing that there is a place, a magical place, called Ciderville. This is Rhea Windcaller, signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Yeehaw!